The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Welcome to the Savage Nation, taking another chance on the tightrope of life. Play it loud, play it proud. Play it loud, play it proud. Attention, attention, listeners to the Savage Nation. Tonight is a holy night to Jewish people and to believing Christians. A night that people around the world recognize as the beginning of, at sundown around the world, in some places already has occurred, the end of one year, the beginning of another. The year 5770 becoming the year 5771 to those who follow the lunar calendar, the Jewish calendar. Now, what does it mean to you? It depends upon who you are. I have no idea who you are. I have no idea who's listening to the show. The majority of this audience is probably 80, 85, 90% Christian. There's probably a small percentage of Jewish people listening to the show and a large percentage of non-religious people. That would be my guess. And so why does it matter if we recognize this night? Well, maybe it doesn't matter to you. To me, it matters because the threat, the existential threat to annihilate the Jewish people from the planet is as real today as it was in King Haman's times in ancient Persia, where we have a new King Haman in the form of Ahmadinejad, who, in my opinion, is a reincarnation of evil. King Haman became Adolf Hitler, became Ahmadinejad. Now, you may say that that's an extremist statement, but that's because you are a fool and you don't know history. I have an astounding political article in my hand that came out today in the Atlantic magazine, where Fidel Castro tells a writer, "Send a message to Ahmadinejad of Iran, stop slandering the Jews." I was shocked by this. Fidel Castro was a dictator for over 40 years, a socialist, a lifetime socialist, a dictator in Cuba. And yet in this interview, Fidel says to the writer at the Atlantic, "Stop slandering the Jews, tell Ahmadinejad that." He said over the course of the first five-hour discussion, Fidel Castro returned to his excoriation of anti-Semitism. He criticized Ahmadinejad for denying the Holocaust and explained why the Iranian government would better serve the cause of peace by acknowledging the unique history of anti-Semitism and trying to understand why Israelis fear for their existence. Now, I want to pause right here. I'm talking about a lifetime communist, a dictator, Fidel Castro. Even he recognizes that Ahmadinejad, unless he is stopped, will drag the entire world into a world war. So he writes, he began this discussion, meaning Castro, by describing his own first encounters with anti-Semitism as a small boy. This is Fidel Castro now. He said, "I remember when I was a boy, a long time ago, when I was 5 or 6 years old, and I lived in the countryside. And I remember Good Friday. What was the atmosphere a child breathed?" He said, "Well, people said, 'God is dead. Be quiet. God died every year between Thursday and Saturday of Holy Week, and it made a profound impression on everyone. What happened?' They would say, 'The Jews killed God. They blamed the Jews for killing God.' 'Do you realize this?" said Castro. He went on, "Well, I didn't know what a Jew was. I knew of a bird that was called a Jew. And so for me, the Jews were those birds. These birds had big noses. I don't even know why they were called that. That's what I remember. This is how ignorant the entire population was." Castro said the Iranian government should understand the consequences of theological anti-Semitism. "This went on for maybe 2,000 years, said Castro. "I don't think anyone has been slandered more than the Jews. I would say much more than the Muslims. They have been slandered much more than the Muslims, because the Jews are blamed and slandered for everything. No one blames the Muslims for anything, said Castro. I want to pause here. This is the dictator of Cuba saying these things. Hillary Clinton, these words could go into Hillary Clinton's ears. He says, no one blames the Muslims for anything. And then he goes on and says, the Iranian government should understand that the Jews were expelled from their land, persecuted and mistreated all over the world as the ones who killed God. In my judgment, here's what happened to them. Reverse selection. What's reverse selection? Over 2,000 years, they were subjected to terrible persecution and then to the pogroms. One might have assumed that they would have disappeared. I think their culture and religion kept them together as a nation. He continued, the Jews have lived an existence that is much harder than ours. There is nothing that compares to the Holocaust. I asked him if he would tell Ahmadinejad what he was telling me. He said, I am saying this so you can communicate it, he answered. I think this is one of the most astounding interviews I've ever read in my life, especially since it comes from a lifetime socialist dictator named Fidel Castro. And so I say to you, that is why it's very important you understand what he said. Listen to what he said. Reverse selection has kept the Jewish people alive. What is reverse selection? He said, I think their culture and religion kept them together as a nation. Now, let's pause at that juncture. Culture and religion kept them together as a nation. Let's take the opposite to the religious Jew, where the culture and religion are kept alive, to the Woody Allens and the Larry Davids of the world, the Hollywood crowd of Jews, let's say, who spit on their own religion, sneer at Christians, and basically have contempt for anything to do with God. You know it and I know it. They don't even understand that they are the end line of their own dissatisfaction with existence. They are the end of their existence. There's nothing to follow them. Perhaps that's the way they see it. But the people that some of you don't even understand, that you have maybe disrespect for or contempt, because they run around in black clothes and they follow absurd religious practices and they live in another universe, they are actually the tattered remnant of the ancestry. Now, that doesn't mean you have to respect them. It doesn't mean all of them are pure. It doesn't mean all of them are saintly. We know that's not true, but that's not the point. We're talking subjectively, but objectively, it is those in the black robes, in the black coats, whether it be in Judaism or Christianity, who keep the religions alive. And so today I say it's very important to recognize what we are talking about when we talk about the Jewish people. It's not the lawyer that you meet. It's not the Hollywood filmmaker that you may hate. It is not that. It is something much different than that. I want to read something that I myself wrote in 1996, which I read every year on the radio. I began on the radio in 1994. In fact, I'm not going to squeeze it in here. It's 2 pages long. I'm going to read some emails I got today, and I will take your calls on the Savage Nation. The phone number is 1-800-449-8255. Beowulf, please play a little bit more of the liturgical music as we take our first commercial break on the Savage Nation. This ray vachara me vekona me vekinu ye vekinu se. Back to the Savage Nation. I'm not like Mother Teresa, don't get me wrong, but I do share something with Mother Teresa in one regard, which is that I'm in constant doubt about the existence of God and what he wants of me, to be frank with you. I'm plagued by doubts about the existence of God and about whether God really cares or whether I'm alone in the universe or there really is, you know, somebody up there who likes me, truthfully. I've had events in my own life which indicate there is something other than me, and something other than events around me that need explanation, for which there are no explanations. So therefore, I, at a certain point, have to go by the way of belief. I know you come to belief in this way, it's not a wholehearted belief, but that's the way it is with me. Maybe you hear it in my voice tonight, or maybe you hear it other nights. You don't hear it at all. You hear a guy who's sure of himself. But when it comes to the God thing, I'm telling you the truth. Some days I just don't know because I can't understand the suffering that he permits. I can't understand the children born with diseases. I can't understand so many things that happen. And then on the other hand, I know miracles exist, and whether they're just chance occurrences. As a scientist by training, I certainly understand those who are skeptical of this whole God concept. And so therefore, I go back and forth myself. I try not to think about it sometimes, to be frank. But on a night like tonight, I do think about it because it is the beginning of the Jewish New Year. And I found this article today. I was shocked by it. I put it up on michaelsavage.com. Fidel to Ahmadinejad, stop slandering the Jews. Just amazing that it came out today. What's interesting about Castro is that here's a man whose island is actually slightly playing with capitalism. They're abandoning some of the socialism that they've used for 40 years, the very elements and tools that the socialists are dropping, Obama is engaging in America. Can you imagine this? That even Fidel Castro has decided to privatize elements of the Cuban economy just when the moronic professor and his circus of clowns are trying to introduce a university of stupidity to American business and American life. More taxes, more regulation, more government control, more of the putz Barney Frank controlling things, more of the schmuck Barney Frank wrecking the economy. It's unbelievable to me. So having said that, I think I have the time to read my sermon. I'm going to read it now, or should I hold it? I'll take a call now. Joel in San Diego, welcome to the show.
Hello, Michael. My question is, just like every Italian is not in the mafia, just like every Muslim isn't involved with terrorism, when you think of the difference between the Jewish people and Zionism, do you know where you can differentiate the difference?
Yeah, well, the setup of your question is biased to begin with, because you're comparing Zionism to the mafia and Zionism to radical Islam.
I apologize for that. I'm just, is there a difference between the group of people that are just the regular go-to-work 8-to-5?
Yeah, it would be the same thing as a difference between Woody Allen and a whole man.
Okay.
Yeah, well, at least you got the joke. You know, Martin Luther King Jr., despite all of the flaws, like all of us, he was a flawed man in many ways, and we know what those flaws are. He said something that I'll never forget. I read it years later. I actually heard the man speak outside the UN in 1960-something. I remember it. It was quite stirring. He was quite an orator, and he moved me. I didn't know anything about civil rights or the civil rights movement truly at the time. I didn't pay much attention. I was a kid. But he said something I'll never forget. He said, make no mistake about it, anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. Those are the words of Martin Luther King Jr. Now go tell that to all of the Jew haters that you meet. Go ahead. Tell that all to the Jew haters out there. Florida, Tony, you're on the Savage Nation.
Yeah, Dr. Savage, do you think that sadistic Stalinist pig, Castro, cares anything about the Jews or Israel? He wants to keep his man in the Oval Office, having both houses, the Senate and the House. He wants an October surprise. He wants Israel, and he wants the United States to bomb Iran, so we got an October surprise, so he doesn't lose the House and the Senate. That's all, man. He cares as
well,
much.
Hold it. I disagree with you, although I think that's likely to happen. The exact opposite is expressed by Castro. He said he doesn't want to see a war between the West and Iran. He sees it coming, but he said he doesn't want to see it happen. He's terrified of it. And one of the reasons that Castro is preoccupied with the threat of a military confrontation in the Middle East between Iran and the U.S. and Israel, one of the reasons is because he knows if that broke out, his country, too, would likely be caught up in the whirlwind. And finally, he would have to pay for all of the sins he has inflicted upon the Cuban people over the last 40 years. There'd be a world change, a sea change throughout the world, and he'd be swept up in it. There's no question about it that once these flames start, this tiny little island of Cuba would be caught up in the conflagration. Chicago, Pam, go ahead. You're on the Savage Nation.
Dr. Savage, it's an honor. I think you're wonderful. You changed my life when you talked about Sam Cohen. I just was reading about that online.
Sam Cohen, when I talked about him, the inventor of the neutron bomb, what, how he wrote about what his mother did to him and all of that?
Yes, yes. And I.
Why? Because were you abused by your mother? Is that what you're saying?
No, no, not at all. But I think that it was so profound to find out what motivates people to do what they do.
Oh, when I said yes, that he created the neutron bomb, he thinks because his mother gave him some of the symptoms of radiation poisoning through her treatment of him, through the enemas and the purges, that he was so traumatized by his mother's insanity that he thought, as an adult, years later, that he invented the neutron bomb to provoke this in millions of people through the neutron bomb. And he was big enough to admit it.
I thought that was profound, and I also did read that article about Fidel Castro, and I thought it was still very significant.
Well, it's very important that you bring this up. What motivates anyone? You think it just comes out of thin air? What motivates Obama to be such a questionable leader that he actually takes the side of the enemies of America rather than America itself? Where did this come from? You want to talk about the president's psychology? I've been doing it since before he was elected. Why does this man have such an animus against the United States of America when he himself has benefited so much from it? Why did he and Michelle Obama, when she said, "I was never proud to be an American until now," do you realize what that says about Michelle Obama, who we're now supposed to believe is a wonderful leader of the American people? I will never forget what she said. In other words, it's only about her. It's never been about the American people. But what makes Obama go around the world and bow down to the leader of China, the dictator of China, bow down to the king of Saudi Arabia, get literally genuflect? Why does he do that, and why does he have such contempt for the patriots of America who believe in this country? Where does that come from? Do you think it comes out of the thin air? How did Obama become Obama as a man? Obviously, it started in his childhood with his mother, because his father figures were quite distant in his life. Both fathers left him. Both fathers were Muslim. His mother, on the other hand, was a peripatetic individual. A peripatetic individual, I'm being quite benevolent when I say that. And as such, he has a woman problem. And as such, he is still insecure, and he is still trying to prove himself not only as a man, but as a leader.
Savage.
You know, before I go further on the Savage Nation, I want to say this. I found a few stories today that I posted on my website. Listen to this one. Bibles destroyed in Afghanistan by U.S. military. The Bibles were burned because the rules say that all garbage must be burned at the end of the day. But if the U.S. military seized a stack full of Qurans, would they burn them? That's the new military under Mike Mullen. U.S. loans Mexico $1 billion to drill in Gulf. Let me repeat that. The United States is loaning Mexico $1 billion to drill in the Gulf of Mexico. What do we have, a foreign power running America? Answer, yes. Tell me how different it would be if an actual foreign power had invaded, conquered the people, disarmed the people, and took over the government. Could it be any different than what he's doing under this president? I don't see how it could be any different other than lining people up and putting them into concentration camps. Every policy that is passed may as well be that of a foreign government who has dominated America. 506,000 caught and released illegals are now fugitives. Individuals who were apprehended, then released ahead of their court proceedings and deemed fugitive when they failed to appear in court, 500,000. You hear what I'm saying? The liberal elites under Obama may as well be a foreign power. Proposed policy would let illegals go free. Black farmers pushed for $1.25 billion payout. Soros to donate $100 million to the radical slime in the Human Rights Watch that hates America. I go on down the list. It seems every story I'm reading to you is about a foreign power having taken over America. Toyota courts customers with Hispanic pride stickers. You hear this? This is in America. Somos muchos Latinos. This is in the United States of America. The majority of Hispanic people in the country, are they of illegal alien status or not? Someone answer that. I don't want to get caught into county welfare to children of illegal immigrants grows. Scandal at Justice Department enabling vote fraud. A top Justice Department official allegedly has openly refused to enforce laws that require states to remove ineligible names, dead people, felons from voter rolls. So if a foreign power took over the country, would they be doing anything differently? I don't know. I doubt it. Let's take a few callers on the one and only Savage Nation. Las Vegas, Dave, go ahead, please.
Hi, Dr. Savage. I was riding in my car, and I heard your statement about, sometimes you question, that there's somebody upstairs that likes you and all that. And I kind of agree. I think the same way sometimes. Then I thought about your remark about, about what Castro said. And then I thought, well, there's your miracle right there, because, what better place than from the way, way, way far Marxist left for God to say something about, anti-Semitism. And
I totally agree. I think that this is a miracle coming through Castro's lips. And I believe he's sending a message to the rest of the socialist universe, meaning China and Russia and all the other communist nations, that they've got to stop supporting Ahmadinejad and or get rid of him. Because remember, he is the godfather of worldwide socialism. He is the titular head of worldwide socialism. Although his nation is small, he's been around longer than all of them. Correct?
Oh, I'm sure of it. Yeah, I mean, it also brings me the other way. As I say, I go through some of the same things, and today was a good day for belief.
All right. Well, that's a very interesting point. You believe Fidel Castro's statements today that we read from the Atlantic magazine, where he told the writer, tell Ahmadinejad to stop slandering the Jews. You believe it's God's will and a miracle. And he acknowledges in the article that he is still a dialectical materialist, meaning a socialist. When I asked him over lunch to answer what I've come to think of as the question, has your illness caused you to change your mind about the existence of God? Castro answered, sorry, I'm still a dialectical materialist. And yet here he's saying, tell Ahmadinejad to stop slandering the Jews, because he's liable to drag the world into a world war. I think that's an amazing statement. He is telling the leaders of China and Russia to stop supporting Ahmadinejad, because they're liable to set off a world war that nobody wants and nobody will be able to control. Which now leads me to my sermon. 3 pages, 2 pages, 1 minute. Thousands of years ago, a little-known man in a Middle Eastern desert tried to lead his people from idolatry and hatred. Today, the descendants of these original tribes of Israel are known as Jews. What, we ask, is a Jew? Is it a religion, a race, a mindset? It is, to me, a constant relationship with God, the eternal Creator. A constant dialogue within ourselves, asking, pleading, demanding, to know why the God will sometimes suffer horrendous fates, or why the evil appear to enjoy, why the good will sometimes suffer horrendous fates, or why the evil appear to enjoy the riches of their plunder. It is this ability to ask without hearing an answer, but to keep asking eternal questions without losing faith in goodness and godness. It is this desire to want to hear the very voice of God without hearing it. It is coming to know that the questions themselves are God's way, which makes the Jewish spirit an eternal manifestation of that transcendental experience in the desert thousands of years ago, which gives each Jewish person a special destiny, a special burden. What is it? To waste the spark of the fire of original knowledge is to throw away not only your own destiny and inheritance, but a portion of the destiny and inheritance of the people chosen by God to be his bearers of the light. Being human and not God, we all sin by missing the mark, and that is my message to my friends gathered here tonight on the Savage Nation. In Hebrew, the word sin does not exist. Did you know that? It does not exist. It translates closely to miss the mark, for God is forgiving, or not one of us listening to the show today would survive a single day. The message is to try to hit the mark again and again. That is the Zen of maintaining the inheritance of God. Seek truth, seek justice. So Rosh Hashanah tonight, the head of the year, marks the beginning of 10 days of awe, a period during which the Jewish people are judged by God, who decides whether they will be inscribed in the book of life for the coming year. It is an intense time for Jewish people, a time of trial and forgiveness. It concludes with Yom Kippur, a day of repentance. And so, as we leave the savage speech and we go into the wilderness of our own lives, I want to wish every listener to this show tonight to remember this. Be happy. God made you. God loves you. That's my speech to you. Maybe it's not as good as Castro's. Let's take the callers. 1-800-449-8255. Also today, I have a special treat for you because I think I have done the religious thing. I'm going to play something we played yesterday. So many people were moved by Henry Miller reading his own work from a Black Spring when he talks about when he was a child, who he was sent in a trolley car to take his aunt to a madhouse and what it did to him. I'm going to play a little bit of that again because it was so touching. Robert in Los Angeles, thanks for... Oh, Robert's gone? Okay, that's fine.
Yes, sir, I'm here.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead, please.
Dr. Savage, a pleasure speaking with you.
Okay,
thank
you.
I want to wish you a happy new year also. I'm a Persian Jewish living in Los Angeles and wanted to let you know that as long as we have Mr. Obama in power, Mr. Ahmadinejad will grow to be stronger and be the biggest enemy of the State of Israel.
Well, let's think about what you said. I don't want to just react as though I didn't really hear you and I'm just shining you on. So it's your supposition that Ahmadinejad is propped up by Obama.
Of course.
Now, first of all, I don't disagree with you because I know that they've dragged their heels on acting against Ahmadinejad, but it started with Bush. Remember that. Bush was also soft on Ahmadinejad, remember?
True.
And so, therefore, it's the United States government itself, the State Department, that wants to keep Ahmadinejad in power. Why is that? Why is it that the United States secretly wants Ahmadinejad in power when he said that he will get a nuclear weapon, he will use the nuclear weapon to annihilate Israel, and he does not care if even 50% of the Iranian people are killed? You know that that's a true statement because you heard it you read it with your own eyes.
I have, yes. I don't have
How do the Iranian people feel about him? I know the women are oppressed under Ahmadinejad. Look, the Persian people were an advanced people before the West even existed. They had an advanced civilization thousands and thousands of years ago. How could the women be turned backwards like this, being put into veils, being told they can't drive, being thrown out of teaching professions? Does the West even know what Ahmadinejad is doing to women there?
Oh, you have no idea. You have no idea. As someone who has relatives in Iran, I can tell you that it is a very oppressive regime. And if you do things which the government disagrees with you, you will just disappear in the middle of the night. No one knows where you went.
Mm-hmm. So it's much worse than it was under the Shah with Savak. It's far worse.
Oh, yeah, obviously. Shah was against the only... He was against the people that were against him. But Ahmadinejad is against everyone.
Right, exactly. You see, what happened was the Shah of Iran had a secret police that the left-wing vermin in America slandered. The left-wing vermin in America said that the secret police under the Shah of Iran were arresting people randomly and torturing them and killing them. What was really going on was the Shah of Iran, a Western-educated man, a good friend of America, was preventing radical Islam from spreading its tentacles throughout Iran and the rest of the world. The Shah of Iran was undermined by none other than Mr. Peanut, Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter undermined the Shah. Jimmy Carter destroyed the Shah's authority. Jimmy Carter permitted Khomeini to come back from exile in Paris. And it was Khomeini who spread the cancer of radical Islam in Iran and then throughout the world. In your opinion, did I just tell you exactly what the truth is?
Absolutely. The biggest ally of the United States in the Middle East was Shah. And there is no one like him, ever.
Yeah, and how many people understand it was Jimmy Carter, the communist, who did this? And also, by the way, Jimmy Carter committed another act recently that he should never be forgiven for. He flew to Venezuela, and he certified the election of none other than the so-called leader of that country. He claimed the election was not fraudulent. Do you know that?
Yes, sir.
Yes. See, many people don't know who Jimmy Carter really is and what his long-term strategy has been and will always be. Never forget Jimmy Carter is a Jew hater. Never forget Jimmy Carter would like to see Israel disappear. Never forget that Jimmy Carter pretends to be a man of peace when, in fact, in some ways, he has caused more harm on the world by bringing back Khomeini than any other man on the planet. That's one man's opinion. It doesn't mean that you have to agree with me. I'll be right back.
Savage.
You know, last night I was watching TV as usual. I'm sorry, I admit I watched too much television. I did as a child, and I didn't watch it for 30 years. I threw a television out of the window once when the children were young, and I came home from a hard day's work, and they didn't even say hello, Daddy. They stared at the tube. I picked it up and threw it down the steps. No, I did. But now I watch too much TV. I mean, just the way it is. So I was watching a show about headhunters. I mean, head shrinkers, not psychiatrists, of course, about the shrunken head, the people in Ecuador who shrink heads, some tribe that did it. They used to be known as the Jivaro, but they've changed to some indigenous name now. And there was some anthropological footage from the 60s that a German anthropologist filmmaker shot. It was unbelievable. Given that I spent many years in the 60s and 70s in Fiji, Tonga, Samoa, and the Palmerston Island, very strange and rare islands that I was on. I have great footage of it. I was very captivated by this. But then they showed an Ecuadorian from the village who had gone to the main city of Quito and become sort of a modern man. And they used him as a translator. So he goes back into the bush, into the jungle, to visit his ancestors to try to see if any of this headhunting business is still going on. And it got me thinking about religion. And I wrote somebody an email today about religion, and I said, I have lost my lust for ultra-religious individuals. They may be a tattered remnant of the original tapestry, and as such, they ought to be protected. But it is as though I returned to the jungle from Quito to see my relatives who still engage in the ritual of shrinking heads. It is time to move on, but to where, I wrote. The Buddhist American church seems so Hollywood. I'll just have to keep the faith without supporting these grifters. I ask, why don't any of them work a regular trade and then practice their religious arts? I wonder, as I write them too many large checks. That's just neither here nor there. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I have my own thing. Having said that, I want to play a segment for you now that's very touching. It's Henry Miller from his own book, Black Spring. Go ahead. And now, ladies and gentlemen, do I have a treat for you? Because during the break, while you chewed gum, smoked a cigarette, had a corned beef on club and left it half uneaten because you couldn't wait to get back in the car and hear what I was going to say next, while you ate a hot dog on a stand on a hot street in New York, or you went for a soda in a cooler somewhere in the deep streets of Pittsburgh, while you were doing that, I was outside the radio studio pumping iron with my 20-pound dumbbells, because that's what I do during breaks in order to aerate my brain and my lungs using the old heart-lung machine called the biceps and the old barbells. My production team downloaded Henry Miller himself reading from his novel, Black Spring. Play it.
It always seemed astounding to me how jolly they were in our family, despite the calamities that were always threatening. Jolly in spite of everything. There was cancer, dropsy, cirrhosis of the liver, insanity, thievery, mendacity, buggery, incest, paralysis, tapeworms, abortions, triplets, idiots, drunkards, ne'er-do-wells, fanatics, sailors, tailors, watchmakers, scarlet fever, whooping cough, meningitis, running ears, chorea, stutterers, jailbirds, dreamers, storytellers, bartenders, and finally, there was Uncle George and Tante Amelia, the morgue and the insane asylum. No one knew that Tante Amelia was going completely off her nut, that when we reached the corner, she would leap forward like a reindeer and bite a piece out of the moon, and nobody could think quick enough to stop it. Just like that, it happened, in the twinkle of a star. And now I'm going to tell you what those bastards said to me. They said, Henry, you take her to the asylum tomorrow, and don't tell them that we can afford to pay for her. Fine. Always merry and bright. The next morning, we boarded the trolley together, and we rode out into the country. If Mealy asked me where we were going, I was to say to visit Aunt Monica. But Mealy didn't ask any questions. She sat quietly beside me and pointed to the cows now and then. She saw blue cows and green ones. She knew their names. She asked what happened to the moon in the daytime. And did I have a piece of liverwurst by any chance? During the journey, I wept. I couldn't help it. When people are too good in this world, they have to be put under lock and key. There's something wrong with people who are too good. It's true Mealy was lazy. She was born lazy. It's true that she was a poor housekeeper. It's true she didn't know how to hold on to her husband when they had found her one. When Paul ran off with the woman from Hamburg, she just sat in a corner and wept. The others wanted her to do something, put a bullet into him, raise a rumpus, sue for alimony. But Mealy sat quiet. She wept. She hung her head. She was like a pair of torn socks that are kicked around here, there, everywhere, always turning up at the wrong moment. And now she's very tranquil, and she calls the cows by their first name. The moon fascinates her. She has no fear because I'm with her, and she always trusted me. I was her favorite. Even though she was a half-wit, she was good to me. The others were more intelligent, but their hearts were bad. Sometimes, when she was fired from a job, they used to send me to fetch her. Mealy never knew her way home. And I remember how happy she was whenever she saw me coming. She would say innocently that she wanted to stay with us. Why couldn't she stay with us? I used to ask myself that over and over. Why couldn't they make a place for her by the fire? Let her sit there and dream, if that's what she wanted to do. Why must everybody work, even the saints and the angels? Why must half-wits set a good example? I'm thinking now that after all, it may be good for Mealy where I'm taking her.
Savage. Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised. And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. I have a question for my audience, a very personal question, a simple one. Are you turned off or turned on by the religious content of the show today? I mean, I started by talking about the Jewish New Year, Rosh Hashanah. I thought it would be of interest to the Christian audience, which is the dominant part of this audience. I've done it in the past, but I'm surprised in some way by the reaction today on the show. I then played a piece from Henry Miller reading from Black Spring, which I loved yesterday, and many of you asked for it again today. But I'm asking you a simple question. Do you feel the show has moved a little too much in the religious area? Do you think it should be a little lighter? Do you think that it's a turn-off or a turn-on? I mean, in plain English. It's all a simple question. You can comment on it if you want. We also talk about Fidel Castro telling a writer for The Atlantic to send the message to the Hitler of Iran to stop slandering the Jews, which I thought was amazing. And, of course, that's just a political commentary. I think that if you want to call the show on this, it's 1-800-449-8255 for you to call. But I think what I want to do right now is play President Obama's greeting in clip three. Listen to this one.
As Jews in America and around the world celebrate the first of the High Holy Days, I want to extend my warmest wishes for the new year. La Shana Tova Tikativu. May you be inscribed and sealed in the Book of Life. Rosh Hashanah marks the beginning of the spiritual calendar and the birth of the world. It serves as a reminder of the special relationship between God and His children, now and always. And it calls us to look within ourselves, to repent for our sins, recommit ourselves to prayer, and remember the blessings that come from helping those in need. At a time
All right, you know what? So far, I agree with every word he says. right? But listen to clip 7. This is interesting. Listen to 7.
The scripture teaches us that there is a time to love and a time to hate. A time for
war. Now stop here. Stop here. He's actually, he's the first president I know who knows the Bible, or somebody who works for him knows the Bible, when he says there's a time for love and a time for hate. Remember the piece I played over and over again by the Birds? Turn, turn, turn. Do you have that ready? Turn, turn, turn. Because he understands that there's a time for love and a time for hate, a time for war and a time for peace. It's not just turning the other cheek, my friend. Stop being a eunuch. Did you hear that? Stop it. A time to kill and a time to heal. You think the American boys who go over to Iraq like to kill? You think they enjoy killing? No, but they understand they're there for a job, and that's to kill. Make no mistake about it. You make no mistake about it. They understand that their destiny hangs by a thread. Every time they go on a patrol in Iraq or in Afghanistan, they understand that. It's kill or be killed. They understand the Bible. They understand it better than most of you who don't even understand it. They understand it very well. So I actually agree with Obama when he says there's a time for love and a time for hate. 1-800-449-8255. Let's take some callers on my question. More or less religion? Yes, sir. Real simple. New York, Marsha, go ahead from WOR. Your opinion counts.
Michael, I loved it. I loved it. I'm Jewish, and the difference between, I pray every day, but the difference between every day and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur is that it's a time for reflection and to take.
Are you alone or are you with a family? Where are you?
I'm right now on the way to see friends for Rosh Hashanah.
That's interesting. So in New York, it's about 12 minutes after 7 p.m. It's not yet sundown on the East Coast. And so hundreds of thousands of people are traveling in cars to meet relatives or to go to a service. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm glad that I could be with you tonight on the Savage Nation. This is AM radio. Never forget it. This is the big league. This is Yankee Stadium. This is Yankee Stadium of this is the Yankee Stadium of the media. You know, make no mistake about it. This is the big, big arena. I had a dream about this last night. I had a dream about this. I'm deeply in touch with my subconscious, or shall I say my subconscious is deeply in touch with me, which is interesting unto itself. And in the dream, I remember thinking, God, that's good, but it's not AM radio. God, that's good, but he's not in AM radio. Because I realized this is the cauldron here. This is it. This is it. This is the big league. Every breath, every word, every inflection, every insight, every mistake is heard around the world. It's a business like no other. I was in the dental chair this morning. I went for minor dental work. And the dentist said to me, she said to me, how are you doing? And I told her. She said, are you still enjoying it? I said, yes. I said, but it's very difficult. She said, why? As the drill, you know. And she scraped away at Mount Rushmore of my teeth. I said, because it's a business like no other. I said, one wrong word, and you lose everything. She said, I said, one wrong word in this business, and you lose everything. I don't think there's another business like it other than politics, where one wrong word could destroy you. Do you know that? Which is why it's very sad our political class has become leaderless. It's not that they're stupid. It's not that they're incapable of leading us, some of them. It's that the times that we live in make it almost impossible to say what you really mean unless you really are so confident in what you mean is going to, you know, be supported. You don't say anything. You talk and double talk. The politicians speak in rhymes. They say nothing. So we've lost interest in them. So who do we turn to? We turn to talk radio. That's absolutely true. Absolutely turn to talk radio for any conversation today. Doesn't mean there isn't any other conversation out there. I was on a friend's yacht the other night, Labor Day, and I met some young people, younger than me by a couple of decades. They happened to be from a South American nation. Lovely couple. Young children weren't there, and we talked. They didn't even know me. I didn't know them. I was introduced by, we just had a, you know, I had a beer. They had drank, blah, blah, blah. He cooked some meat.
And we talked. So there are very intelligent people out there who talk with each other, obviously. But I'm talking about in the media. There's no other dialogue. Certainly it's not on ABC, CBS, or NBC. It's a format that doesn't lend itself to conversation. Television, they've tried the talk format in television. It doesn't work for whatever reason. I've seen it tried. Yes, Joan, you're on from Columbus, Ohio. What do you say, Joan? Blah, blah, blah. Somehow it doesn't grip me. Why does talk radio grip you? Why do millions of people rely upon talk radio for their link to reality? I ask myself, but I know the answer. I, Merlin the Magician of talk radio, know the answer. Why? Because there's no props. There's no props. There's no makeup. There's no lights. There's no distractions. There's no flashes. Every minute a flash with the news on television. You can get Petite Mal watching the news. And the crossing in the legs and the lipstick in the hair. The poor girls, what they have to do to attract your attention. I don't have any of that. And even if I could, I wouldn't cross my legs and put on lipstick for your attention. I don't have to do that. So what do I have? Nothing but my brains, my heart, my knowledge, and my voice. That's all. And if you're lucky enough to be able to combine all of that and project it out into the media, through the media to the world, you're a very lucky man. But it's all a miracle. At the end of the day, it's all a miracle. I guess I believe in miracles in that regard. Mr. Pragmatist here, Michael Savage, hard-nosed savage, believes in miracles. It's all a miracle. You want to hear something amazing? If you open up the Bible, the Jewish prayer book, rather, I want to read one paragraph. Please indulge me. You want to hear something? Here is the morning prayer that a religious man is supposed to read every morning. Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who has formed man in his wisdom and created within him numerous orifices and cavities. It is revealed and known before the throne of your glory that if one of them were to be blocked or one of them were to be opened, it would be impossible to exist even for a short while. Blessed are you, Lord, who heals all flesh and performs wonders. Now, think about that. When was that written? Before the age of anatomy? The ancient Jews knew about arteries and veins, that if one of them were to be blocked or one of them were to be opened, it would be impossible to exist even for a short while. So let's say you're a warrior. Let's say all day long you worry about a heart attack. Oh, God, every cringe in a car. You're 32 years old, you have two children or whatever, and every second you feel indigestion, you think you're dying. Oh my God, what's that? Cardioneurosis, every second. What you're really doing is praying, but you don't realize it. By fearing death, you're actually reaching out to God and saying, please don't kill me. I have two young children or I'm alone. I don't want to die here in the car. I don't want to crash into a light pole. In essence, it's very funny when you think about it. But the fear of disease and fear of death, obsessional fear of death and disease, is actually a few steps removed from worship of God, the worship of God. I'm the only one who's ever seen this. It was revealed to me in a dream. God told me to tell you that today. So let's say you're not only a hypochondriac of a minor order, but a major hypochondriac. What you're really doing is sublimating your wish to pray to God to keep you alive another second. And so it would be simpler if actually you stopped being a hypochondriac and you actually prayed to God six times a day and said these prayers in whatever language or whatever means you meant to. You just say, God, you know, we have all these vessels and these this and these that. And you know what? I'm enjoying my life. I'm not a bad guy. Or say to yourself what I learned to say the other day. I saw it in a Chinese fortune cookie. Do you know that I learned from a Chinese fortune cookie if it's good? Do you know that I can learn from a Chinese fortune cookie? I must have read them for 30 years and thrown them out. They're silly. I saw one the other day that I swear to God saved me. You know what it said? It saved me temporarily. It said, your virtues outweigh, your virtues outweigh your faults. That's what it said. Your virtues outweigh your faults. You know when I get down on myself, I immediately go into that statement. When I say, oh, I did this, I did that, how come I didn't do this? Why didn't I do more push-ups? Why didn't I say nicer to this one? Why did I lose my temper? You know what that is. That's the road to perdition when you're starting with that one. Don't beat yourself up. Say your virtues outweigh your faults. We all have faults. But are your virtues more than your faults? Good. That's it. So are a human being. So that's why I'm giving you this religious stuff today, because I want to. How do you feel about it, though? That's what I'm asking you. You like it or you don't like it? You want me to stop it never again? You want me to do it more? You want me to do it less? I mean, look, America has a hardcore religious base. You take a highway that runs from the east coast of Florida, and it goes all the way through the southern states. I have a friend in the media who says to me, why? He said, I listen to you on Highway 40. He said, I get you from one state to the next, all through the night, all through the day. He likes to drive in a car alone. He collects his thoughts or whatever. He said, you're Highway 40. I pick you up Louisiana, then I get you in Texas. Then I get you in the Panhandle, and then I get you in New Mexico. Then I get you in Arizona. He said, you got to stay on the air. He said, Michael, you're the voice of America. I'll be right back.
Savage.
So you see what I mean? Whatever you start to talk about, if you follow it, it's ultimately very political. So if I tell you that you're fearing death is really a desire to pray to God, I don't know that I've ever read that anywhere. That was quite original. I stumbled upon it, but that's the beauty of free thinking. That's the beauty of free thinking. I mean, if you've trained your mind to not be afraid of your own thinking and your own thoughts, and you trust in your own ability to think, you come up with wonderful insights. How long has it been since you've... How many people even have insights anymore? And they're afraid of their own mind. How many of you are afraid of your own thinking? You're terrified. You're told as a child, it starts with a child, where you say, don't think so much. I was told as a child, my mother, God bless her, she was afraid of me. She was afraid for me. She saw the dark eyes. I'd go into my states of thinking on my own, and they didn't know what I was doing. Little did they know they had a prophet. Your old men shall dream dreams, and your young men shall prophesy. Did you know that? Your children shall prophesy. Did you ever read that in the Bible? Did you know that it was written? Your old men shall dream dreams, and your young children shall prophesy. So sometimes parents have a kid who's sort of like that, deep, thoughtful, and they get scared. They don't know what he's doing. So they don't know what to do with him. Today they put him in a quack job. They put him on a drug. Oh, he's too introspective. He doesn't study well. He can't memorize. Take him to the quack called the pediatrician. She'll give him a pill, and he'll be fine right after that. Turn him into a little drug addict. Put him on Ritalin at age 2. Make sure he can't think at all. Turn him into a zomboid who votes D or R, holds a job at an insurance company, comes home to a wife and 1.1 child. That's what you want. Make sure the child is subdued, suppressed, held down, controlled, put in the center line. Go straight, young man, go straight. Put that round peg in a round hole. Don't let that weirdo get away. That the weird one cut the weird parts off of him. Make sure he goes into a round hole or a square hole. Watch out for those kids with the oddball shapes. Those are the ones that cause the trouble. That's the conformity that we live in America today. Conformity, conformity, conformity. Many parents would rather have a drug addict as a child than a nonconformist child who they don't understand. Do you know that? I am so sick and tired of reading about an addict. Every time I open up the news, some old actress, oh, she talks all about her addiction. Who the hell cares? Oh, man, she exposed this. Some old actress who can't get a job anymore because her behind fell down or whatever. Now, all of a sudden, she's revealing she was an addict all those years. Like, I care. That's the role model? That's the role model? Some old Hollywood actress was an addict? Big deal. I don't even pity her. I don't know her. What do I care about her? What do I care about another actress who was an addict? That's a role model for a young child today? That they admit they're an addict. Oh, I was secretly an addict, or I'm secretly gay. I don't care. Why is that something to be proud of? Why don't you tell me about the Eagle Scout? Why don't you tell me about the young man who went to West Point and became a congressman? Why don't you tell me about the kid who invented something? I'm sick of people who did nothing but their whole pride in life is that they're a sexual deviant or they're an addict. I'm sick of it. The whole country's upside down because of the upside down media. It's all crazed. That's why your children are mixed up, and that's why they're on drugs.
Savage.
Is the Savage Nation. Very interesting day, believe me. And I have a very interesting guest right now because he's everything good about America.
You saw what just went on in the primaries in Alaska, didn't you, where an incumbent Republican by the name of Murkowski was defeated by an unknown, that is unknown to the rest of America, by and large, named Joe Miller. And the media did everything they could to have you disrespect Joe Miller. They did not want him to win. He is a favorite and was a favorite of the Tea Parties, and he won. But the media didn't like him. They never mentioned that he was really a war hero. Did you know that Joe Miller graduated West Point, where he graduated with honors? You didn't know that. The media hid that from you. Did you know he's a graduate of Yale Law School and holds a master's in economics? You know that he was awarded the Bronze Star for his leadership in combat during the first Gulf War. And then he went on to become an attorney and a judge in Alaska. They made you think Joe Miller, just a local yokel. They hid everything from you. That's how they are. That's why the country hates the media. That's why the country hates incumbents. And now I introduce you, my friends, to Joe Miller, an Alaskan by choice. Joe, congratulations on your victory, and welcome to the Savage Nation.
Michael, thanks for having me on.
Now, I'm very impressed with your background, and I'm really sad that the media would hide all these wonderful attributes of your past. How could they hide that you graduated from West Point and you received the Bronze Star? Obviously, they were intimidated by this, don't you think?
Well, you know, the media has their own agenda. I'm sitting here dealing with it up in Alaska right now with them describing me as some sort of outside extremist that, you know, doesn't have any interest of Alaskans, that just out there beating the Tea Party wagon, and that's all I'm about. But, you know, I'm more concerned, frankly, about them misdescribing our positions on virtually every issue that's coming before Alaska right now.
Well, you moved to Alaska how long ago? 16 years ago, and they're trying to make you an outsider?
Well, I mean, it's this idea that I don't care about Alaska, even though my children were born here, even though all my property is here, even though I'm vested in this state, and I'm going to stay in this state forever. I mean, I expect to be buried in this great land. But, you know, for them to basically look at this as something that is designed for anything other than to get this nation moving ahead and get this state moving ahead is ridiculous, but they've got a different agenda. That's all there is to it.
But Joe, you were a U.S. magistrate judge in Fairbanks?
I was a U.S. magistrate judge clear up until 2004.
Amazing how far you move so quickly. So you're going to win, you won the primary, and you're running against an unknown Democrat, correct?
Yeah, but he's becoming more known. Of course, the media is cooperating on that as well.
Yes, of course. But let's say you do win, you'll become a congressman, correct?
Right, I'll be in the U.S. Senate.
Oh, you'll be a senator. I'm sorry, forgive me, that's great. Boy, do we need you in the Senate. You'll be one of the very few who actually graduated West Point, let alone fought in combat during any war. You'll be one of the very few and very proud.
Yeah, that is a kind of interesting facet of the Congress, is that there are fewer and fewer combat vets serving the United States in the Congress. And so I think that is a good addition. A lot of folks just don't know what our servicemen and women are going through. And I think that perspective is critical, not just for that purpose, but also for national security purposes.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree with you. And all of your policies make sense to me. They are on government spending, limited. Healthcare, you want to repeal Obamacare. Cap and trade, the science supporting man-made climate change is inconclusive. You're against it. You're unequivocally pro-life, and life must be protected. In other words, everything you believe in is anathema to the socialist left.
Yeah, pretty much. I agree with you. And that's one of the reasons why we've got the battle we have with the media.
Well, you don't have it with me. You don't have it with Michael Savage, Joe.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, what we want to make sure is that Alaskans understand that they've got a good choice to move the state forward. You know, we're focused on states' rights, moving the resource base back under the control of the state, out from under the thumb, the heavy hand of the federal government. It really is the only answer, because our federal government, of course, is going bankrupt.
Now, isn't Alaska primarily a Republican state? The people are very individualistic in that regard, like America in general, the other lower 48 were 50 years ago. Aren't most Alaskans very conservative?
Yeah, Alaskans are. I mean, the interesting characteristic, though, of Alaska is that the majority of Alaskans are nonpartisan or undeclared. In other words, they don't affiliate with either party. But, of course, at the core of most Alaskans' experience is that of kind of a a conservative outlook. They want to make sure government's not, you know, in their back pocket or in their backyard. And that's one of the reasons why my message resonates so strongly across the state.
Joe Miller, let me ask you this. Is Alaska inundated with illegal aliens, or you're so removed from the main 48 that that's not an issue there at all?
You know, it is an issue. In fact, you know, we've taken a real strong stance on illegal aliens. You know, you shouldn't reward law-breaking with benefit. It's a national security issue. It's a national health issue. All of those facets that it seems this crisis of leadership in D.C. is just completely ignored. But, you know, I talked to a guy. He came into my office. He read my position on illegal aliens on the website, joemiller.us. And he said, you know, Joe, I just went out to a work site here in Fairbanks. I couldn't understand a word anybody was saying. They all spoke a language different than English.
Where are they from? Where are they coming from in Alaska? That's the part that bewilders me.
Well, you know, we've got the biggest coastline of course, any state in the Union, more coastline than the whole United States combined. We've got a border with Canada, so we've got that issue, too. But I think, you know, primarily the reason that we've got people that are very activated on that is they see it as a national security issue.
No, Joe, I'm sorry, I posed the question wrongly. Which country of origin are the majority of illegal aliens coming from?
You know, I can't give you a good set answer on that. I don't think there's statistics that reflect that, at least that I'm aware of here. We do know that it's a problem, certainly not nearly as big a problem as in the lower 48, but it's enough of an issue that people up here talk about it.
But I would think that the native population, the indigenous people, the Inuits, would not be great friends of the illegal aliens. Is that correct?
Well, I think that it's just overall, Alaskans are Alaskans. They believe that people ought to comply with the law, and they don't like people coming in, taking jobs, and violating the law and getting benefit for it.
Plain English. In plain Alaskan English, you don't have to speak a foreign language to know the law is the law and breaking the law is illegal. Well, Joe Miller, it's a great victory for America to see a man like you of great, you know, really a great background to finally make it into politics and to actually be motivated to want to be a U.S. Senator. God, do we need you, and I thank you for being with us. How do people reach you? What's your website, Joe?
Michael, joemiller.us is the best way to donate, the best way to learn more about us. We'd appreciate all the support we can get.
You got it. Thanks for being with us on the Savage Nation.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you. 1-800-449-8255. That's Joe Miller from Alaska. Didn't hear one word of the fact that he had graduated from West Point. Not one word that he was a combat veteran with a Bronze Star. Not one word from the wonderful people who bring you the propaganda every day on ABC, CBS, and NBC. Not one word from the wonderful, fair-minded talking heads. Not one word till it was all over. Unbelievable to me. Hawaii, Joe, talking about another state that's not connected to the lower 48. In Hawaii, Joe, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Dr. Savage, it's great to talk to you. Yeah, we just went from Joe the American hero to just your average Joe over here. I'm just a farmer on the north shore of Oahu growing corn.
Corn on Oahu? Corn on Oahu, that's like cows in Berkeley, moo.
And somehow I just stumbled upon it, you know, going through the stations out here as I'm driving around the farm. And I've always been a seeker of truth, doctor. And I never did get it in the world and in the media. I remember being 15 years old. I'm 40 now, and I'm sitting there watching the news, and I'm just thinking to myself, why the heck are they calling this news? Because it's a bunch of rubbish. And I just got fed up with it, and I started doing my own research, and I started finding things that that you have already found out, and I know that because you're saying things that I'm feeling, and that's why American loves you, because you're saying what we are feeling and seeing.
Well, let me ask you something about reality. Corn in Hawaii, you have a market for it off the island or where?
No. I was actually born in Houston, Texas back in 70. And, you know, I used to surf the Gulf of Mexico, which is pretty much rubbish surf. And
No. Did you say you're growing corn in Hawaii? Did I hear the wrong word?
What's that now?
Did you say you are growing corn in Hawaii?
That's right. We're producing corn seed right up here on the North Shore above Haleiwa.
Because if your call had come from L.A., I would have thought you said you were making porn in Los Angeles.
No, sir.
So well, you come from a surfer background, but now you're growing corn. Where do you sell your product?
And I like to verify knowledge for myself, and I go out and I start telling people about the truth.
But Joe, where do you sell your corn? Who buys it? Is it on the island or do you export it?
Okay, yeah, the corn we're growing is strictly for seed. It's for a very large corporation, and so what I do is I take a handful of seed, I multiply it into a bag of seed, and then they ship that seed to the mainland and to South America and other places, and they just grow it out into hundreds of acres, and then that corn seed goes to market for farmers around the world.
Is there still money to be made in Kona Coffee if I bought a plantation? Is there any money in it?
Oh, yeah. You know, you got to get your little niche market. For example, we got an ex-surfer out here who's now selling Kona coffee that he's not growing, but he's got his picture on the thing, and it's this.
No. I always wanted to buy a... No, I had always had a fantasy years and years ago of owning a little coffee plantation in the hills of Hawaii. I never went into it, though. I don't know the first thing about farming. You know, I have three fruit trees in my backyard. To me, it's a miracle to grow six pears, 12 peaches. I mean, when a peach comes up, I put a peach seed, a peach pit in the ground with my heel about 5 years ago. A miracle to see the peach tree grow. Of course, they didn't bear very well this summer. It's been very windy out here in Northern California. They dropped all their fruits on the ground. It's kind of sad, but to me, it's a miracle. The whole thing of nature is astounding to me. And when you think about what a farmer goes through, you understand how real a farmer is. How different a farmer from an academician, I say to myself. The academician on tenure, who knows nothing about life, virtually nothing. But what does the farmer know? The farmer is amazed at what he has to go through to raise that crop. The number of people in academia who just sit on the dole, in essence, they're on dole. They don't know much about reality. They don't know anything about whether it's going to rain or the wind is strong. And so the strange, strange life of academia and so-called scholarship, as opposed to that of the working man, as embodied in the farmer, is amazing to me. You know, the farmer. The farmer doesn't wear elbow patches on his suit jacket. The farmer doesn't go into an office wearing hiking boots or subarctic parkas. The farmer does not go into an office setting looking as though he's going on a safari. That's only for the professors who drive Land Rovers along with their Priuses to make that they're actually on a safari every time they go to the university. The farmer, on the other hand, knows exactly what he needs. He knows exactly what he needs, and he knows exactly what his life depends upon. And he also knows that without global warming, there would be no farm crops whatsoever. He realizes that the reason we have such a bountiful America and such a bountiful world is precisely because the little ice age ended, and ushered in was the little age of global warming over the last 300 years, which permitted the crops to grow. Because had there been no global warming, we would all, we certainly would have an Earth that's probably one-fifth the size of the human population than it is today. So every time I bite into a peach or bite into a bagel in the morning, I say, God, thank you for giving us global warming. I'll be right back. I want to conclude this hour by talking about the reverend in Florida who wants to burn the Qurans. You don't have to take a position on it to understand what's going on here. What's interesting to me is that the very same people in the State Department, like Hillary Clinton, who never said a word about the burning of the American flag, for example, is now offended by the burning of the Quran. The very same Hillary Clinton who said nothing about the removal of the Ten Commandments around the country when she was president. Remember Judge Moore? How they took down the Ten Commandments everywhere, never said one word about it, is now concerned about the burning of the Quran. The very same Hillary Clinton who said not one word when the degenerate vermin from Brooklyn Museum, showed a crucifix in a jar of urine, is now concerned about the desecration of the Quran. The very same Hillary Clinton and the other folks in the U.S. government who are now so concerned about the burning of the Qurans by this marginal church in Florida said nothing when a so-called artist put a picture of the Virgin Mary in elephant dung. They said, oh, it's freedom of speech, they said. It's the First Amendment. Although I don't agree that we should put the Virgin Mary in dung, it's the artist's right to stick a picture of the Virgin Mary in dung, they said. when flags were burned, they said, well, it's the First Amendment. It's what our troops are dying for. It's the right for the left-wing, pot-headed vermin to burn the flag, they said. But now, when a little preacher in a small church in Florida wants to burn some books, they say, oh, you can't do that. That's un-American. That's un-American. Then we have the head general in Afghanistan saying it's going to endanger the troops. I would say that the general has endangered the troops with his failed rules of engagement. The media swept under the rug that eight American soldiers were killed yesterday or 2 days ago by a so-called Iraqi soldier. The Iraqi soldier wasted eight American troops, killed two of them, seriously wounded six. How did he do it? My guess, and the media won't follow it, is that they were sent in there without arms. They were part of a security detail. The American soldiers were sent in as bodyguards, in essence, to a company commander who had a meeting with some Iraqi warlord. And my guess is that Petraeus's rules of engagement said, oh, we're the ugly American. We'll come in unarmed to show you that we mean peace. And your Iraqi soldiers, they can have weapons because we know we can trust you. And so he wasted two and wounded six. And to me, that's what endangers the American troops more than the burning of a book in Florida. But here we go. Here we go. Eric Holder, who has attacked the people of Arizona for wanting to defend themselves against the drugs and the illegal aliens, he's calling it idiotic. Vatican says it's outrageous. Clinton says it's disgraceful. But the reverend says the burning will proceed. So you see, there's a lot of different ways to look at everything. My guess is that the U.S. government may prevent him from burning the Korans. And at the same time, if you go to michaelsavage.com, you'll see a story that would get you sick. The U.S. military burned Bibles in Afghanistan. They threw them in the garbage. They burned them because they were told to do so by the State Department. They said that you cannot translate the Christian Bible into the local language because it's provocative to the Muslims. And so they made them burn Bibles in Afghanistan. So you talk about double, triple, quadruple standards. It's worse than a quadruple bypass. America has had a quadruple bypass under liberalism. They've given us a heart attack, a soul attack, a brain attack, a bone attack, a lung attack. And now they're telling us it's time to bury the dead. So there it is. That's one man's opinion. Let's go to the callers in the remaining moments of the show. Let's pick up a caller out of Tampa, Florida. Welcome to the program. Devita, go ahead, please.
Appreciate your program, and yes, I vote yes, a thousandfold. Please do this format again. I could have answered and had a beautiful dialogue with you. You raised so many fascinating points during your first hour. Would have been a fascinating conversation. If I could just quickly share a thought that I think is really unique among thinking among Jewish people. To me, if you look at Exodus, we would see that it's really Passover, which is the beginning of the month for us.
Let me say this. I would love to hear this. I unfortunately am out of time. I don't have the time. And I know that you're a thoughtful woman. So don't think I'm being disrespectful to your thinking. Let's do this when we have time. I normally do religion on Fridays. But because tonight is the night of, you know, the Jewish New Year, and so many people in the Christian world even look to the Jewish people in some ways, and I mean the religious ones, I don't mean the Bonnie Franks. They look to the Jewish, the keepers of the faith, let's put it to you that way. Is that a better way to put it? The Christian people who are fundamentalists look to the keepers of the faith with respect. You understand what I just said? And that's why it's important that I do this. And so tonight we go from 5,770 to 5,771, according to the ancient calendars. The ancient calendar of the Jewish people.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Welcome Beginning of the Jewish New Year known as Rosh Hashanah. Of course, it's a fairly well-established holiday in the United States, which is a nation founded on Christian principles, which are built on the Jewish Bible. And Obama gave a greeting for Rosh Hashanah, which, of course, you can play. It is alleged or thought or in tradition, Jewish tradition, that at this time, the beginning of the new year, and people believe, especially if they're children, I suppose, that during these 10 days of awe between Rosh Hashanah and the Day of Atonement 10 days from now, God decides by your behavior whether you're going to be written in the book of life for the coming year. Well, I hear some emails that I got on this subject. One is from a psychiatrist. And he said, Michael, let's share in the spirit and hope and promise of the new year. 5,771, he wrote. Like most people, I retain a bit of the thrill of religion as it impresses ideas of the child mind. On the child mind. In this case, I responded positively as a child to the allegory about the book of life. I was somewhat in awe of the rabbi at the temple I went to as a child. He was a striking figure in black robe and with tallis framing his craggy and heavy-set face with big facial features and huge hands, a result of his pituitary tumor. Yes, he had acromegaly, but somehow that was less important than the large size of his knowledge and his personal and special access to Judaica and the Hebrew language. Torah is a fascinating voyage through ancient history, bringing the stories of the Jews up to date and relevant in our own time, as your own readings and interpretations make abundantly clear. Perhaps this will be the year when you or someone else will clarify the details of the Jewish calendar arithmetic, dating its origin to the distant past, earlier than any part of man's written record, back 5,771 years. Is that for real? He writes, I had thought that dated to the time of Abraham, but it is more likely that a council of rabbis or perhaps divine authority itself claimed that as the dawn of creation itself claimed that as the dawn of creation. That is what makes Rosh Hashanah so special for me in the inner recesses of the spiritual mind. It is not only a celebration of tomorrow today, but also a celebration of the beginning of time. Am I the only child man who likes that connection to the beginning? I'd ask the rabbi I knew as a child, but he is long gone. So that leaves you, Michael Savage. Maybe some of your listeners will respond if you ask about it. Anyway, Happy New Year, 5,771. And anyway, here's what I wrote back. I have lost my lust for the ultra-religious. They may be a tattered remnant of the original tapestry, and as such are to be protected. But it is as though I returned to the jungle from Quito, Ecuador, to see my distant relatives, who I find out are still engaging in the ritual of shrinking heads. It is time to move on, but to where? The reform are all impossible. The Buddhist American church seems so Hollywood. I'll just have to keep the faith without supporting the grifters in religion. I wonder why so few of them actually work a regular trade and then practice their religious arts. I wonder why so many of them live on welfare. I wonder, as I write them too many large checks. I guess I'll just speak to God alone tonight. I have to have another sip of coffee. I had a bad night. Hold on. Now, let's see, Dr. Savage. You're going to talk about nutrition and you're drinking evil coffee? Yes, my friends, because coffee is one of the finest drinks that that the world has ever seen. And you know who brought coffee to the attention of the Western world? It was the Arabs, incidentally. You don't know this. But they noticed the Africans drinking a liquid derived from, I think they didn't roast them at that time. They were drinking them in, I think it's Ethiopia, pretty sure. Ethiopia, yes. and in the mountains of Ethiopia. And the indigenous people of Ethiopia were drinking this liquid, which stimulated them. And since Muslims are not permitted to drink alcohol, and they needed something to keep them awake during the many prayer sessions during the day, coffee was the perfect solution. And the Arabs actually brought coffee into Europe. You may know the Europeans picked it up from the Arabs at that time, whichever way you want to put it. It's a very interesting story. At some point, I was a student of so-called economic botany, where I studied the history of these things. This is the Savage Nation, heard across America on, I don't know, 300 stations, who knows? Hundreds and hundreds of stations, millions and millions of people tuning in every day to find out what I'm going to say next, what I said next, what did he say before, what does he think? I'll be right back.
Savage.
You know, we've talked about the story of Nasir Abdo, who, after joining the army, has decided to apply for conscientious objector status because he said being a soldier in the U.S. Army may not be permissible according to Islamic doctrine. I wonder which ACLU creep fed him that. But not everyone who is a Muslim agrees with this slime. Joining us now from the American Islamic Forum for Democracy is Dr. M. Zudi Jasser. Dr. Jasser, welcome back to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me on again. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Remind us what you think this guy is trying to do here.
Yeah, I mean, I can't tell you, Mike, how close this hits to home, in that we formed our organization, the American Islamic Forum for Democracy, to show that there are American Muslims that are patriotic, believe in our armed forces and what we're doing. And this gentleman, Nasir Abdo, has started his own website, Free Nasir. He has basically taken public his claims that he doesn't want to. He joined the military a year ago, the beginning of 2009, and now 6 months later or a year later has said that he doesn't want to deploy to Afghanistan or Iraq because he does not want to, quote-unquote, kill Muslims or be involved in a war against Islam. And then he goes on to cite a litany of other, what I believe are not only illegitimate but just fabricated excuses, saying that, well, he's unable to do his prayers and as an army enlisted, he's unable to practice his faith, and that he feels that the environment is anti-Islam. And, you know, this was being portrayed by a lot of the quote-unquote mainstream media as being a legitimate concern. He's seeking conscientious objector status, and we basically are put out a strong statement saying not only do we condemn this, but it is just un-Islamic, and a lot of his interpretations are wrong.
Wrong? Well, what do you mean by that?
I can't tell you how important it is to understand the distinctions we're talking about as patriotic Muslims. You know, ABC asked the head of the Islamic Society, or the Islamic Law Council of North America, who used to be the head of ISNA, and what his response was, and he said, well, there are a lot of good Muslims that serve in the U.S. Army and a lot of other places, but then he never went on to say why this guy is off base. And I'll tell you what he's wrong. First of all, CO status legitimately in the military means that you will not serve in any wars in any military and that you're basically a pacifist.
Mm-hmm.
This gentleman is not saying that. He's saying that he just doesn't want to serve in this war against certain people, which is not conscientious objection, but basically picking and choosing your wars. So from the DOD directive 1300, that's completely wrong, and he should not get awarded that. As a Muslim, there's no Muslim that can read our Quran and say that it's a pacifist religion. It talks about just war, and I think one of the biggest areas of reform that need to happen is for Muslims to reinterpret the concept of jihad.
Well, is that what you did?
When I joined the military, I not only subscribed to my citizenship oath, but the oath of as an officer that I would protect this nation from enemies, domestic and abroad, and that it didn't have any exclusion as to what the faith of my enemies are. And if anything, my parents left oppressors that were so-called Muslims and have been able to practice their faith in this country more than any other so-called Muslim country in the world. And that's why I think this man doesn't only not understand Islam. Our Islamic obligation is to serve our oath in America. Our Islamic obligation is to reinterpret jihad so that the concept of a global Muslim nation goes away and we have primary and final allegiance to countries like the United States.
How do you think this will turn out?
Well, I hope that the DOD refuses his request for CO status. He has been using foreign media, Islamist media, and Al Jazeera to get his victimology platform heard wherever possible, especially with our enemies. And there are many others like him. The Washington Post did a story about a Zachary Klawan, who, after Fort Hood, said that he was being, and he was stationed at Fort Hood, and he made very similar complaints and saying that he didn't know if he wanted to be deployed either. So we have to, I think, set examples of these individuals, declare not only is their CO status refused, but that they actually, and I think Muslim organizations should step up and say that this man is a traitor. He is not only a traitor to this country, but dishonors what it is to be an American Muslim. And I think organizations like CARE, ISNA, and others that are not willing to make that kind of a strong statement are actually contributing to the climate that makes it seem like this is a war against Muslim and a war against Islam.
Hmm.
And I think they are contributing to that slippery slope, and it's important for us to make a clear stance that we want the military not to, to recognize that the faith is pacifist, because it's not. It's never been. We believe in just war, no different than the Jewish faith or Christian faith has throughout its years. And I think similarly, I hope the DOD refuses his assertion of CO status and says that Muslims can't simply claim that as part of their faith.
So you're saying you think he should be punished to the full extent of the Uniform Code of Justice? Good for you.
Yeah, and I think the punishment is, okay, when an individual says that they want to declare CO status, they still should feel that they want to fulfill their obligations. He signed up for the military, and that has obligations. You can't vacillate with that obligation and pick and choose. Otherwise, unit cohesion becomes meaningless, and the ability to follow orders and maintain what your mission is and listen to your superior officers becomes completely moot and becomes irrelevant.
Right, right, right.
And that's why he can't put it up and say, well, they're going to deploy me now, and if I get deployed, I'm going to be abused and persecuted. And basically he's saying that his fellow enlisted are his enemies and that they're going to hurt him. And there's been no evidence in his interviews to say that. And I think that, if anything, he is saying the words of our enemies. And, you know, I'll tell you that I think that the UCMJ, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, speaks clearly that when people enlisted refuse to follow orders, they get punished for that. They become deserters or unauthorized absence or whatever the appropriate designation is. They should be punished to that extent and not allow them to use their faith, especially when so many Muslims serve honorably and have been trying to lead this and say, you know what, we have an obligation to fix the problems within the House of Islam, and one of the ways we do that, among the others, including the war of ideas, is to actually serve in the armed forces that are setting so many countries like Afghanistan free from its oppressors like the Taliban or Saddam Hussein.
Well, he knew all this going in when he signed up in 2009, obviously.
And that's so true, in that this guy, when he signed up, he didn't sign up in 1999. He signed up in 2009, knowing full well where our main theaters of war were. So basically, either this guy became a coward, and I think it's interesting if you look at his media appearances, which I think also, I can't believe who's not punishing him just simply for speaking outside the military about what's happening inside. He's violated, I think, a number of codes of the UCMJ. But having said that, I can't believe that, you know, look at his initial statements. He was saying he didn't want to fight in Iraq or Afghanistan. Then later, seems like after he lawyered up, he then found out that he has to say all wars and all conflicts, etc. And, you know, I think that's really evidence that his heart really is confused. And if anything, he is siding with the enemies of this country rather than with American interests.
Well, do you think this is the main issue here?
Yeah, I think that the important thing with this issue is to really highlight it's not just about one soldier. It's not about conscientious objection. It is about the fronts in this war of ideas, and that ultimately this man's heart got pulled into political Islam and the victimology and the collectivizations of Muslims as one ummah in Arabic, or in English, that's Muslim community or nation. And until we can counter that and say we have zero tolerance for that lack of loyalty, I don't think we're going to win this war, and we're going to continue to see more Nidal Hassans and others. I mean, imagine Nidal Hassan, before he decided to get pulled into Imam Awlaki's violence, If this guy had found any mom like him, instead of going through a CO status, he would have slipped down into becoming a violent jihadist, no different than Nidal Hassan. So this is part of a process. Muslims aren't either just good or bad binary. There's a continuum that we need to stop and break in the ideological battle, and I think this issue cuts into that deeply.
Dr. Jassa, tell us more about your organization.
Our organization, the American Islamic Forum for Democracy, our website is AIFdemocracy.org, AIFdemocracy.org. It's based on the fact that we believe terrorism is simply a tactic, that ultimately the conflict, the slippery slope that creates radical Islamists is the belief in political Islam. And the only way to defeat that is to separate mosque and state in Islamic beliefs and separate the personal practice of Islam as a faith from the political movement that includes trying to install Sharia law, create Islamic states, and the collectivization of Muslims globally against the West, which they view as un-Islamic or anti-Islamic, and really teach the Muslim community, especially in a reform process, that we can be very Islamic in countries like America, and we don't want to change them in a supremacist mindset.
Dr. Jassa, thanks for being on the Savage Nation.
Thank you for having me, Michael. It's been nice to be with you again. Thank you.
The mainstream media would have you believe that what they show you is the only point of view out there. But as more genuine people speak out, we actually start to see the truth about what's really going on in the world of politics, in the world of reality.
Savage.
Today we've been talking about the economy and finances, and now Rick Santelli of CNBC joins us on the Savage Nation. Rick, thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks, Michael.
Well, Rick, I'm not going to drag you into politics, as I know you're a very quiet, soft-spoken man, and you don't want to talk about him. I want to talk about the economy, and I figured we needed a real expert. People are afraid of the stock market. I'm not going to say should they put their money in. I mean, that's your business, but should they put their money in the market, and what should they do? I don't mean exact stocks. How should they play the market?
Well, you know, I think that there's institutions out there that are the toll keepers for many small retail, you know, your average listener, to make things a bit easier. It's a pretty fast-paced game these days, and in May we had something that has been dubbed the flash crash. And what it demonstrates is that there's a lot of high-tech horsepower behind many that trade in stocks. And I think for individuals to try to compete with some of these systems is very difficult, even if you're a long-term investor, just not day trading. I think the stock market always has a place in somebody's portfolio, especially for the long horizon, but a couple of asterisks. You want to pick your institution carefully, look at track records and performance, obviously, and B, you probably also want to diversify to the point where anything that you have in equities, your timeline is at least a handful of years down the road. I think that the stock market is a bit dicey these days, and I'll tell you why. I think that the price of stocks, keep in mind the S&P 500 reflects a value of probably 50% that is involved in exporting, meaning that the U.S. economy in and of itself isn't the only thing affecting some of these stock indices. And I think that the country's going to be in for a bit of a rough road, and I think that the value of the stock market isn't necessarily a good surrogate for the state of the U.S. economy.
So let's say an average person had $10,000 extra, and they had it in T-bills, and they want to put, well, let's say they have 100 grand, they want to put 10,000 of it into stocks. Are you suggesting don't play the game yourself because you're going to get swamped by a bigger wave? And so therefore, what, go into a mutual fund? Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, I think mutual funds are a very good, efficient route to go. Now, not to say that if you're a listener and you're thinking to yourself, well, listen, I'm not going to day trade. I'm not going to be in and out on a given day, given week, or even given month. I'm a value investor. I'm going to be in for the longer haul. Of course, I think an individual like that can try to do it on his own. And I think in terms of research, the Internet, there's so much available, whether it's your show, CNBC, there's plenty of ways an investor can arm himself intellectually. It's the competing for the process. And, of course, competing in the process of stocks is going to be much more difficult the shorter term your horizon is to trade.
Rick Santelli, look, I watch you on CNBC. One of my favorite shows on CNBC is the American Greed series. I love that one. We all like to see the bad guys get caught. So, you know, we think they're all caught, but they're not. There's still a lot of manipulation going on. And that leads me to the next question, Rick. What is your long-term opinion of the U.S. dollar? Is it going to hold on there, or are they going to dump it as the prime currency of the world?
Well, it's a very difficult question to answer because there's so many unique aspects of the U.S. greenback. And the major aspect I'm referring to is it's the reserve currency of the world. In other words, you know, whether it's crude oil or sugar, most commodities are denominated in dollars. Many transactions in the world, of course, are in dollars. So it being the reserve currency, it gets a little special treatment. And that special treatment is giving us the ability, I think, to have a form of bad behavior without getting penalized in the here and now. In other words, things like stimulus, things like deficits, the logistics of how the government deals in those topics is through the printing press, whether it's dollars or through the Treasury issuing securities. So there's a lot of paper involved, and ultimately it's going to be worth a bit less. The real question is, how can you avoid taking the hit on the dollar? Because they deem these fiat currencies, and we're not the only ones. The euro, the yen, they're all in a similar strait, and that's why we've seen gold in the $1,200 camp, because it is, in essence, a form of currency that isn't on paper and, of course, retains its value. However, I'm not necessarily advocating gold. So to answer your question specifically, you're going to hear a lot of the experts right now in the here and now talking about deflation or disinflation. But on the backside of what I deem deleveraging, I don't like any of the disinflation words. The price of assets, financial assets, houses, anything is going down because they were too frothy, and that's one of the aspects that created the credit crisis. So the process of these prices coming down is actually a normal part of the healing process. But many try to impact that, like the Fed, Ben Bernanke. He doesn't want prices to come down so rapidly, so they do things like quantitative easing, in which the case they print money. So the short answer is, I still think the greenback is a very safe currency. But on the backside of these lower prices, at some point, our economy and the world economy are going to get through these structural issues, these headwinds, the post-credit crisis economy we're in. And when that happens, we're going to see inflation. So ultimately, I think the dollar is going to have a flight path on a 5 to 10 year horizon that's going to be inflationary. But I don't see that the average guy can totally get around that. You can have investments in other currencies, but you're going to have the same problem there as well.
You basically have faith in the dollar, correct, Rick?
I have faith in the dollar because I have faith in Americans, and I think in November is going to be the beginning of a process to make sure that the country stays on the rails that the founders wanted it to ride on.
Well, what about the Treasury Secretary, Geithner? Without talking about him specifically, he doesn't seem to have much experience in business.
Well, what I would say about the Treasury Secretary is prior to being Treasury Secretary, he was head of the Bank of New York. And during the years that we were planting the seeds that eventually turned into the credit crisis, he had the regulatory mission and the authority to do lots of things that could have averted the credit crisis, whether it was some of the processes to get a loan, the requirements for people that originate loans. You know, many of us in the marketplace saw that this was going to end badly. So my answer with regard to Treasury Secretary Geithner is that I believe that the as president of the Bank of New York, that he really could have done a better job as a regulator. And I do think that when he and Mr. Paulson, then Treasury Secretary, in the fall of 08, basically went on TV and told the world that unless we had $750 billion appropriated by Congress and what was known as TARP, that the financial world, as they knew it, would cease. I don't agree with that assessment. So, you know, it's not about the man. I don't think that the Treasury Secretary, let's rephrase. Mike, if I had the job, I would have done things a lot differently.
Okay. So is it possible that Obama may get the message from the people in November when there's a sweep of Democrats out of the House, which all prognosticators are predicting? We don't know the extent of it. Do you think he might switch to a Treasury Secretary with some more fiscal responsibility, to put it bluntly?
Well, I can't answer that. I know that President Clinton, of course, in 94, made adjustments. He was a very savvy politician. I'm
yes.
not so sure about this administration.
Right,
but I
right.
do believe that on November 2nd, that the silent majority of Americans are going to be heard, and I think it's going to be a tsunami in terms of...
We all feel it. So, okay, so you went from trading futures to trading in ideas, because that's what you do now for CNBC. Basically, you're selling your ideas. I'm in the same business as you. And that's very interesting. People believe in you because you tell the truth. You were also a man who was very clear. You don't like the idea of the government paying for people's mortgages who can't pay them. You talked about Cuba, which once had mansions and a decent economy. And, of course, now they're playing checkers and backgammon and driving 54 Chevys. I wouldn't mind getting a good 54 Chevy out of Cuba, by the way. But your main point is that the government is promoting bad behavior, and most Americans agree with you. All of the election trends support that the Tea Parties were right. Their candidates are winning. And so I think we're going to see more of this rather than less of this, no matter what the left says. And that leads me to the main question, which is the economy, the economy, the economy. Not to blame who did it. There's a lot of blame to go around. I mean, I was calling Bush a fiscal socialist 2 years ago, and people didn't like me saying that because they think that I normally would support a Republican. I saw the government spending. I saw the increase in the size of government. Well, if you were hired by the Obama administration, Rick, and they said, Rick, what would you do to make this economy, the dollar better and the economy stronger? What would you advise?
Oh, that's easy. The first thing I would do is completely revamp the tax code, the tax structure. It's very inefficient. I don't think it's fair. I think that would be the first place I would start out. But the second spot would be to do a better overall accounting. In other words, things like wars are off balance sheet. Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae, FHA, these government-sponsored enterprises, we used to call them GSEs. I now call them GSZs for government-sponsored zombies. They're off the balance sheet, and they're spending as if there's no tomorrow. If the average American only knew that they are still making loans guaranteed by the government for 3.5% down, it's just a travesty.
Oh, my God. Rick Santelli, this was a brand new show for me on finance. I want to thank you for initiating it with me on the Savage Nation. We're all going to watch you on CNBC. You're going to have, I think, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of new devotees. I hope you join us again on the Savage Nation.
Savage.
First, Petraeus did it. Now Hillary Clinton is breaching the separation of church and state to condemn the church that is going to burn the Quran in Florida. Now remember, it's Hillary Clinton, in my opinion, I'm guessing now, who had something to do with my being banned in Britain. I'll tell you why one day. It's in my book, Banned in Britain, by the way. Listen to Hillary.
We're a country of, what, 310 million plus right now, and I mean, it's regrettable that a pastor in Gainesville, Florida, with a church of no more than 50 people, can make this outrageous and distressful, disgraceful plan and get, you know, the world's attention. But that's the world we live in right now. I mean, it doesn't in any way represent America or Americans or American government or American religious or political leadership.
You call it leadership? Next.
We are hoping that the pastor decides not to do this. We're hoping against hope that if he does, it won't be covered.
Bonne chance.
An act of patriotism. But I think that it, you know, it's unfortunate. I mean, it's not who we are. And we just have to constantly be demonstrating by our words and actions. And as I remind, you know, my friends around the world, in the environment in which we all now operate, anybody with an iPhone, anybody with a blog can, you know, put something out there which is outrageous.
The biggest outrage are your policies. And here is President Obama trying to pretend now that he's a friend of Jewish voters.
As Jews in America and around the world celebrate the first of the High Holy Days, I want to extend my warmest wishes for the new year. La Shana Tova Tikativu. May you be inscribed and sealed in the book of life.
Oh, come on.
Rosh Hashanah marks the beginning of the spiritual calendar and the birth of the world. It serves as a reminder of the special relationship between God and his children.
And here's Harry Reid, shaking like a reed, trying to wriggle out of responsibility for the economy being in shambles.
Senator Reid told us he bears no responsibility for the sorry state of Nevada's economy.
You know that I had nothing to do with the massive foreclosures.
Can
here.
You believe
you
this?
You know that I had nothing to do with these unemployment figures. In fact, I worked hard to change them.
Here's DNC Chairman Tim Kaine saying, I'm going to withhold support for those Dems who dare to criticize Obama and Pelosi.
I tend to be a little more helpful to those who are energetically and enthusiastically telling about the good things that the party has done.
Let's stop for a minute. I know you listen because this is one of the last places you can get real, honest, independent conservative opinions and unfiltered news. And I want you to get the full impact of the Savage Nation. Go to TRN1.com, become a premium member, and get Savage Live, Savage Archives, and the Savage Podcast at TRN1.com. Click on my picture at TRN1.com today. Now I want to go on to something that was quite surprising. And here it is. I picked up an article today from The Atlantic where a writer went to Cuba to visit Fidel Castro, the dictator, for so many years, 40-some-odd years a dictator, all right? And he visits Castro, and Fidel says to him, send the message to the Hitler of Iran, he doesn't call him that, Ahmadinejad, stop slandering the Jews, which I thought was amazing. 84-year-old Castro, and of course a lifetime dictator, make no mistake about it, he's trying to act the statesman now. But this is amazing that he would say that. And here's what he said. Castro opened our initial meeting by telling me that he had read the recent Atlantic article carefully and that it confirmed his view that Israel and America were moving precipitously and gratuitously toward confrontation with Iran. This interpretation was not surprising. Castro was the grandfather of global anti-Americanism, and he has been a severe critic of Israel. His message to Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israel prime minister, he said, was simple. Israel will only have security if it gives up its nuclear arsenal. And the rest of the world's nuclear powers will only have security if they, too, give up their weapons. Now, of course, this is never going to happen. This could be Obama giving a speech. But then he goes on, and he writes, Castro's message to Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, was not so abstract, however. Over the course of this first five-hour discussion, Fidel Castro repeatedly returned to his excoriation of anti-Semitism. He criticized Ahmadinejad for denying the Holocaust, and explained why the Iranian government would better serve the cause of peace by acknowledging the unique history of anti-Semitism and trying to understand why Israelis fear for their existence. Castro began this discussion by describing his own first encounters with anti-Semitism as a small boy. He said, I remember when I was a boy a long time ago, when I was 5 or 6 years old, and I lived in the countryside. He said, and I remember Good Friday. What was the atmosphere a child breathed? What was it? Be quiet, God is dead. God died every year between Thursday and Saturday of Holy Week, and it made a profound impression on everyone. What happened, they would say? The Jews killed God. They blamed the Jews for killing God. Do you realize this? He went on. Well, I don't know what a Jew was. I didn't know what a Jew was, he writes. I knew of a bird that was called a Jew, and so for me the Jews were those birds. These birds had big noses. I don't even know why they were called that. That's what I remember. This is how ignorant the entire population was, close quote. Castro goes on in this amazing interview. He said the Iranian government should understand the consequences of theological anti-Semitism. This went on for maybe 2,000 years, he said. I don't think anyone has been slandered more than the Jews. I would say much more than the Muslims. They have been slandered much more than the Muslims because they are blamed and slandered for everything. No one blames the Muslims for anything, said Castro. The Iranian government should understand that the Jews were expelled from their land, persecuted and mistreated all over the world as the ones who killed God. In my judgment, here's what happened to them. Reverse selection. What's reverse selection? Over 2,000 years, they were subjected to terrible persecution and then to the pogroms. One might have assumed that they would have disappeared. I think their culture and religion kept them together as a nation, Castro continued. The Jews have lived an existence that is much harder than ours.
There is nothing that compares to the Holocaust. The writer says, I asked him if he would tell Ahmadinejad what he was telling me. He said, I am saying this so you can communicate it, he answered. Castro went on to analyze the conflict between Israel and Iran. He said he understood Iranian fears of Israeli-American aggression, and he added that, in his view, American sanctions and Israeli threats will not dissuade the Iranian leadership from pursuing nuclear weapons. He said, unlike Cuba, Iran is a profoundly religious country, and he said that religious leaders are less apt to compromise. He noted that even secular Cuba has resisted various American demands over the past 50 years. Anyway, there's much more in the article, but what I found astounding here is that this lifetime communist dictator, even Fidel Castro, understands that Israel's back is to the wall, and that Ahmadinejad just as likely to set off World War III with his insane anti-Semitism. So, at a certain time, you know, politics makes strange bedfellows. And I even agreed once with Charles Schumer, so in this case, I now agree with Fidel Castro. Savage.